religious leaders, I became aware of subtleties in the way they treated me. I had not perceived it before, but now I saw that many of them resented my presence. For example, when they introduced me to each other, they often used Bahasa terms that, according to my dictionary, translated to inquisitor and interrogator. I purposely neglected disclosing my knowledge of their language. Even my translator knew only that I could recite a few stock phrases. And I purchased a good Bahasa English dictionary, which I often used after leaving them. Were these addresses just coincidences of language? Misinterpretations in my dictionary? I tried to convince myself they were. Yet the more time I spent with these men, the more convinced I became that I was an intruder, that an order to cooperate had come down from someone, and that they had little choice but to comply. I had no idea whether a government official, a banker, a general, or the U.S. Embassy had sent the order. All I knew was that although they invited me into their offices, offered me tea, politely answered my questions, and in every overt manner seemed to welcome my presence, beneath the surface there was a shadow of resignation and rancor. It made me wonder, too, about their answers to my questions and about the validity of their data. For instance, I could never just walk into an office with my translator and meet with someone. We first had to set up an appointment. In itself, this would not have seemed so strange, except that doing so was outrageously time-consuming. Since the phones seldom worked, we had to drive through the traffic-choked streets, which were laid out in such a contorted manner that it could take an hour to reach a building only blocks away. Once there, we were asked to fill out several forms. Eventually, a male secretary would appear. Politely, always with the courteous smile for which the Javanese are famous, he would question me about the types of information I desired, and then he would establish a time for the meeting. Without exception, the scheduled appointment was at least several days away, and when the meeting finally occurred, I was handed a folder of prepared materials. The industry owners gave me 5- and 10-year plans, the bankers had charts and graphs, and the government officials provided lists of projects that were in the process of leaving the drawing boards to become engines of economic growth. Everything these captains of commerce and government provided, and all they said during the interviews, indicated that Java was poised for perhaps the biggest boom any economy had ever enjoyed. No one, not a single person, ever questioned this premise or gave me any negative information. As I headed back to Bandung, though, I found myself wondering about all these experiences. Something was deeply disturbing. It occurred to me that everything I was doing in Indonesia was more like a game than reality. It was as though we were playing a game of poker. We kept our cards hidden. We could not trust each other or count on the reliability of the information we shared. Yet, this game was deadly serious, and its outcome would impact millions of lives for decades to come. Chapter 7. Civilization on Trial. "I'm taking you to a Dalang," Razi beamed. "You know, the famous Indonesian puppet masters." He was obviously pleased to have me back in Bandung. "There's a very important one in town tonight." He drove me on his scooter through parts of his city I did not know existed, through sections filled with traditional Javanese kampong houses, which looked like a poor person's version of tiny tile-roofed temples. Gone were the stately Dutch colonial mansions and office buildings I had grown to expect. The people were obviously poor, yet they bore themselves with great pride. They wore threadbare but clean batik sarongs, brightly colored blouses, and wide-brimmed straw hats. Everywhere we went, we were greeted with smiles and laughter. When we stopped, children rushed up to touch me and feel the fabric of my jeans. One little girl stuck a fragrant frangipani blossom in my hair. We parked the scooter near a sidewalk theater where several hundred people were gathered, some standing, others sitting in portable chairs. The night was clear and beautiful. Although we were in the heart of the oldest section of Bandung, there were no streetlights, so the stars sparkled over our heads. The air was filled with the aromas of wood fires, peanuts, and cloves. Razzie disappeared into the crowd, and soon returned with many of the young people I had met at the coffee house. They offered me hot tea, little cakes, and satay, tiny bits of meat cooked in peanut oil. I must have hesitated before accepting the latter, because one of the women pointed at a small fire. "Very fresh meat," she laughed. "Just cooked." Then the music started, the hauntingly magical sounds of the gamelong, an instrument that conjures images of temple bells. "The Dalang plays all the music by himself," Razzie whispered. "He also works all the puppets and speaks their voices, several languages. We'll translate for you." It was a remarkable performance, combining traditional legends with current events. I would later learn that the Dalang is a shaman who does his work in trance. He had over 100 puppets, and he spoke for each in a different voice. It was a night I will never forget, and one that has influenced the rest of my life. After completing a classic selection from the ancient texts of the Ramayana, the Dalang produced a puppet of Richard Nixon, complete with the distinctive long nose and sagging jowls. The U.S. president was dressed like Uncle Sam, in a Stars and Stripes top hat and tails. He was accompanied by another puppet, which wore a three-piece pinstriped suit. The second puppet carried in one hand a bucket decorated with dollar signs. He used his free hand to wave an American flag over Nixon's head in the manner of a slave fanning a master. A map of the Middle and Far East appeared between the two, the various countries hanging from hooks in their respective positions. Nixon immediately approached the map, lifted Vietnam off its hook, and thrust it to his mouth. He shouted something that was translated as, "Bitter, rubbish, we don't need any more of this." Then he tossed it into the bucket and proceeded to do the same with other countries. I was surprised, however, to see that his next selections did not include the domino nations of Southeast Asia. Rather, they were all Middle Eastern countries, Palestine, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. After that, he turned to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Each time, the Nixon doll screamed out some epithet before dropping the country into his bucket, and in every instance, his vituperative words were anti-Islamic, Muslim dogs, Mohammed's monsters, and Islamic devils. The crowd became very excited, the tension mounting with each new addition to the bucket. They seemed torn between fits of laughter, shock, and rage. At times, I sensed they took offense at the puppeteer's language. I also felt intimidated. I stood out in this crowd, taller than the rest, and I worried that they might direct their anger at me. Then Nixon said something that made my scalp tingle when Razzie translated it. "Give this one to the World Bank. See what it can do to make us some money off Indonesia." He lifted Indonesia from the map and moved to drop it into the bucket, but just at that moment, another puppet leaped out of the shadows. This puppet represented an Indonesian man, dressed in batik shirt and khaki slacks, and he wore a sign with his name clearly printed on it. "A popular Bandung politician," Razzie explained. This puppet literally flew between Nixon and Bucketman and held up his hand. "Stop," he shouted. "Indonesia is sovereign." The crowd burst into applause. Then Bucketman lifted his flag and thrust it like a spear into the Indonesian, who staggered and died a most dramatic death. The audience members booed, hooted, screamed, and shook their fists. Nixon and Bucketman stood there, looking out at us. They bowed and left the stage. "I think I should go," I said to Razzie. He placed a hand protectively around my shoulder. "It's okay," he said. "They have nothing against you personally." I wasn't so sure. Later, we all retired to the coffee house. Razzie and the others assured me that they had not been informed ahead of time about the Nixon World Bank skit. "You never know what to expect from that puppeteer," one of the young men observed. I wondered aloud whether this had been staged in my honor. Someone laughed and said I had a very big ego. "Typical of Americans," he added, patting my back congenially. "Indonesians are very conscious of politics," the man in the chair beside me said. "Don't Americans go to shows like this?" A beautiful woman, an English major at the university, sat across the table from me. "But you do work for the World Bank, don't you?" she asked. I told her that my current assignment was for the Asian Development Bank and the United States Agency for International Development. "Aren't they really all the same?" She didn't wait for an answer. "Isn't it like the play tonight showed? Doesn't your government look at Indonesia and other countries as though we're just a bunch of..." She searched for the word. "Grapes," one of her friends coached. "Exactly, a bunch of grapes. You can pick and choose. Keep England, eat China, and throw away Indonesia." "After you've taken all our oil," another woman added. I tried to defend myself, but was not at all up to the task. I wanted to take pride in the fact that I had come to this part of town and had stayed to watch the entire anti-U.S. performance, which I might have construed as a personal assault. I wanted them to see the courage of what I had done, to know that I was the only member of my team who bothered to learn Bahasa or had any desire to take in their culture, and to point out that I was the sole foreigner attending this production. But I decided it would be more prudent not to mention any of this. Instead, I tried to refocus the conversation. I asked them why they thought the Dalang had singled out Muslim countries, except for Vietnam. The beautiful English major laughed at this. "Because that's the plan." "Vietnam is just a holding action," one of the men interjected, "like Holland was for the Nazis, a stepping stone." "The real target," the woman continued, "is the Muslim world." I could not let this go unanswered. "Surely," I protested, "you can't believe that the United States is anti-Islamic." "Oh, no?" she asked. "Since when?" "You need to read one of your own historians, a Brit named Toynbee. Back in the 50s, he predicted that the real war in the next century would not be between communists and capitalists, but between Christians and Muslims."
"Arnold Toynbee said that?"
I was stunned.
"Yes, read Civilization on Trial, and The World and the West."
"But why should there be such animosity between Muslims and Christians?" I asked. Looks were exchanged around the table. They appeared to find it hard to believe that I could ask such a foolish question.
"Because," she said slowly, as though addressing someone slow-witted or hard of hearing, "the West, especially its leader, the U.S., is determined to take control of all the world, to become the greatest empire in history. It has already gotten very close to succeeding. The Soviet Union currently stands in its way, but the Soviets will not endure. Toynbee could see that. They have no religion, no faith, no substance behind their ideology. History demonstrates that faith, soul, a belief in higher powers, is essential. We Muslims have it. We have it more than anyone else in the world, even more than the Christians. So we wait. We grow strong."
"We will take our time," one of the men chimed in, "and then like a snake we will strike."
What a horrible thought.
I could barely contain myself. "What can we do to change this?" The English major looked me directly in the eyes.
"Stop being so greedy," she said, "and so selfish. Realize that there is more to the world than your big houses and fancy stores. People are starving, and you worry about oil for your cars. Babies are dying of thirst, and you search the fashion magazines for the latest styles. Nations like ours are drowning in poverty, but your people don't even hear our cries for help. You shut your ears to the voices of those who try to tell you these things. You label them radicals or communists. You must open your hearts to the poor and downtrodden instead of driving them further into poverty and servitude. There's not much time left. If you don't change, you're doomed." Several days later, the popular Bandung politician, whose puppet stood up to Nixon and was impaled by Bucket Man, was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver. Chapter 8. Jesus Seen Differently. The memory of that Dalang stuck with me. So did the words of the beautiful English major. That night in Bandung catapulted me to a new level of thinking and feeling. While I had not exactly ignored the implications of what we were doing in Indonesia, my reactions had been ruled by emotions, and I usually had been able to calm my feelings by calling on reason, on the example of history, and on the biological imperative. I had justified our involvement as part of the human condition, convincing myself that Einar, Charlie, and the rest of us were simply acting as men always have, taking care of ourselves and our families. My discussion with those young Indonesians, however, forced me to see another aspect of the issue. Through their eyes, I realized that a selfish approach to foreign policy does not serve or protect future generations anywhere. It is myopic, like the annual reports of the corporations and the election strategies of the politicians who formulate that foreign policy. As it turned out, the data I needed for my economic forecasts required frequent visits to Jakarta. I took advantage of my time alone there to ponder these matters and to write about them in a journal. I wandered the streets of that city, handed money to beggars, and attempted to engage lepers, prostitutes, and street urchins in conversation. Meanwhile, I pondered the nature of foreign aid, and I considered the legitimate role that developed countries, DCs in World Bank jargon, might play in helping alleviate poverty and misery in less developed countries, LDCs. I began to wonder when foreign aid is genuine and when it is only greedy and self-serving. Indeed, I began to question whether such aid is ever altruistic, and if not, whether that could be changed. I was certain that countries like my own should take decisive action to help the sick and starving of the world, but I was equally certain that this was seldom, if ever, the prime motivation for our intervention. I kept coming back to one main question. If the objective of foreign aid is imperialism, is that so wrong? I often found myself envying people like Charlie, who believed so strongly in our system that they wanted to force it on the rest of the world. I doubted whether limited resources would allow the whole world to live the opulent life of the United States, when even the United States had millions of citizens living in poverty. In addition, it wasn't entirely clear to me that people in other nations actually want to live like us. Our own statistics about violence, depression, drug abuse, divorce, and crime indicated that although ours was one of the wealthiest societies in history, it may also be one of the least happy societies. Why would we want others to emulate us? Perhaps Claudine had warned me of all this. I was no longer sure what it was she had been trying to tell me. In any case, intellectual arguments aside, it had now become painfully clear that my days of innocence were gone. I wrote in my journal, "Is anyone in the U.S. innocent? Although those at the very pinnacle of the economic pyramid gain the most, millions of us depend, either directly or indirectly, on the exploitation of the LDCs for our livelihoods. The resources and cheap labor that feed nearly all our businesses come from places like Indonesia, and very little ever makes its way back. The loans of foreign aid ensure that today's children and their grandchildren will be held hostage. They will have to allow our corporations to ravage their natural resources, and will have to forego education, health, and other social services merely to pay us back. The fact that our own companies already received most of this money to build the power plants, airports, and industrial parks does not factor into this formula. Does the excuse that most Americans are unaware of this constitute innocence? Uninformed and intentionally misinformed, yes, but innocent? Of course, I had to face the fact that I was now numbered among those who actively misinform. The concept of a worldwide holy war was a disturbing one, but the longer I contemplated it, the more convinced I became of its possibility. It seemed to me, however, that if this jihad were to occur, it would be less about Muslims versus Christians than it would be about LDCs versus DCs, perhaps with Muslims at the forefront. We in the DCs were the users of resources, those in the LDCs were the suppliers. It was the colonial mercantile system all over again, set up to make it easy for those with power and limited natural resources to exploit those with resources but no power. I did not have a copy of Toynbee with me, but I knew enough history to understand that suppliers who are exploited long enough will rebel. I only had to return to the American Revolution and Tom Paine for a model. I recalled that Britain justified its taxes by claiming that England was providing aid to the colonies in the form of military protection against the French and the Indians. The colonists had a very different interpretation. What Paine offered to his countrymen in the brilliant Common Sense was the soul that my young Indonesian friends had referred to, an idea, a faith in the justice of a higher power, and a religion of freedom and equality that was diametrically opposed to the British monarchy and its elitist class systems. What Muslims offered was similar, faith in a higher power and a belief that developed countries have no right to subjugate and exploit the rest of the world. Like colonial Minutemen, Muslims were threatening to fight for their rights. And, like the British in the 1770s, we classified such actions as terrorism. History appeared to be repeating itself. I wondered what sort of a world we might have if the United States and its allies diverted all the monies expended in colonial wars, like the one in Vietnam, to eradicating world hunger, or to making education and basic health care available to all people, including our own. I wondered how future generations would be affected if we committed to alleviating the sources of misery and to protecting watersheds, forests, and other natural areas that ensure clean water, air, and the things that feed our spirits as well as our bodies. I could not believe that our founding fathers had envisioned the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to exist only for Americans. So why were we now implementing strategies that promoted the imperialist values they had fought against? On my last night in Indonesia, I awoke from a dream, sat up in bed, and switched on the light. I had the feeling that someone was in the room with me. I peered around at the familiar Hotel Intercontinental furniture, the batik tapestries, and the framed shadow puppets hanging on the walls. Then the dream came back. I had seen Christ standing in front of me. He seemed like the same Jesus I had talked with every night when, as a young boy, I shared my thoughts with him after saying my formal prayers. Except that the Jesus of my childhood was fair-skinned and blonde, while this one had curly black hair and a dark complexion. He bent down and heaved something up to his shoulder. I expected a cross. Instead, I saw the axle of a car with the attached wheel rim protruding above his head, forming a metallic halo. Grease dripped like blood down his forehead. He straightened, peered into my eyes, and said, "If I were to come now, you would see me differently." I asked him why. "Because," he answered, "the world has changed." The clock told me it was nearly daylight. I knew I could not go back to sleep, so I dressed, took the elevator to the empty lobby, and wandered into the gardens around the swimming pool. The moon was bright. The sweet smell of orchids filled the air. I sat down in a lounge chair and wondered what I was doing here, why the coincidences of my life had taken me along this path. Why Indonesia? I knew my life had changed, but I had no idea how drastically. Anne and I met in Paris on my way home to attempt reconciliation.
Even during this French vacation, however, we continued to quarrel. Although there were many special and beautiful moments, I think we both came to the realization that our long history of anger and resentment was too large an obstacle. Besides, there was so much I could not tell her. The only person I could share such things with was Claudine, and I thought about her constantly. Anne and I landed at Boston's Logan Airport and took a taxi to our separate apartments in the Back Bay. Chapter 9. Opportunity of a Lifetime. The true test of Indonesia awaited me at Maine. I went to the Prudential Center headquarters first thing in the morning, and while I was standing with dozens of other employees at the elevator, I learned that Mac Hall, Maine's enigmatic octogenarian chairman and CEO, had promoted Einar to president of the Portland, Oregon office. As a result, I now officially reported to Bruno Zambotti. Nicknamed the Silver Fox because of the color of his hair and his uncanny ability to outmaneuver everyone who challenged him, Bruno had the dapper good looks of Cary Grant. He was eloquent, and he held both an engineering degree and an MBA. He understood econometrics and was vice president in charge of Maine's electrical power division and of most of our international projects. He also was the obvious choice to take over as president of the corporation when his mentor, the aging Jake Dauber, retired. Like most Maine employees, I was awed and terrified by Bruno Zambotti. Just before lunch, I was summoned to Bruno's office. Following a cordial discussion about Indonesia, he said something that made me jump to the edge of my seat. "I'm firing Howard Parker. We don't need to go into the details except to say that he's lost touch with reality." His smile was disconcertingly pleasant as he tapped his finger against a sheaf of papers on his desk. 8% a year. That's his load forecast, can you believe it? In a country with the potential of Indonesia. His smile faded, and he looked me squarely in the eye. "Charlie Illingworth tells me that your economic forecast is right on target, and will justify load growth of between 17% and 20%. Is that right?" I assured him it was. He stood up and offered me his hand. "Congratulations, you've just been promoted." Perhaps I should have gone out and celebrated at a fancy restaurant with other Maine employees, or even by myself. However, my mind was on Claudine. I was dying to tell her about my promotion and all my experiences in Indonesia. She had warned me not to call her from abroad, and I had not. Now, I was dismayed to find that her phone was disconnected, with no forwarding number. I went looking for her. A young couple had moved into her apartment. It was lunchtime, but I believe I roused them from their bed. Obviously annoyed, they professed to know nothing about Claudine. I paid a visit to the real estate agency, pretending to be a cousin. Their files indicated they had never rented to anyone with her name. The previous lease had been issued to a man who would remain anonymous by his request. Back at the Prudential Center, Maine's employment office also claimed to have no record of her. They admitted only to a special consultant's file that was not available for my scrutiny. By late afternoon, I was exhausted and emotionally drained. On top of everything else, a bad case of jet lag had set in. Returning to my empty apartment, I felt desperately lonely and abandoned. My promotion seemed meaningless, or, even worse, to be a badge of my willingness to sell out. I threw myself onto the bed, overwhelmed with despair. I had been used by Claudine and then discarded. Determined not to give in to my anguish, I shut down my emotions. I lay there on my bed, staring at the bare walls for what seemed like hours. Finally, I managed to pull myself together. I got up, swallowed a beer, and smashed the empty bottle against a table. Then I stared out the window. Looking down a distant street, I thought I saw her walking toward me. I started for the door, and then returned to the window for another look. The woman had come closer. I could see that she was attractive, and that her walk was reminiscent of Claudine's, but it was not Claudine.
My heart sank, and my feelings changed from anger and loathing to fear. An image flashed before me of Claudine flailing, falling in a rain of bullets, assassinated. I shook it off, took a couple of Valium, and drank myself to sleep. The next morning, a call from Maine's personnel department woke me from my stupor. Its chief, Paul Mormino, assured me he understood my need for rest, but he urged me to come in that afternoon. "Good news," he said, "the best thing for catching up with yourself." I obeyed the summons and learned that Bruno had been more than true to his word. I had not only been promoted to Howard's old job, I had been given the title of chief economist and a raise. It did cheer me up a bit. I took the afternoon off and wandered down along the Charles River with a quart of beer. As I sat there, watching the sailboats and nursing combined jet lag and vicious hangover, I convinced myself that Claudine had done her job and moved on to her next assignment. She had always emphasized the need for secrecy. She would call me. Mormino had been right. My jet lag and my anxiety dissipated. During the next weeks, I tried to put all thoughts of Claudine aside. I focused on writing my reports on the Indonesian economy and on revising Howard's load forecasts. I came up with the type of study my bosses wanted to see, a growth in electric demand averaging 19% per annum for 12 years after the new system was completed, tapering down to 17% for 8 more years, and then holding at 15% for the remainder of the 25-year projection. I presented my conclusions at formal meetings with the international lending agencies. Their teams of experts questioned me extensively and mercilessly. By then, my emotions had turned into a sort of grim determination, not unlike those that had driven me to excel rather than to rebel during my prep school days. Nonetheless, Claudine's memory always hovered close. When a sassy young economist out to make a name for himself at the Asian Development Bank grilled me relentlessly for an entire afternoon, I recalled the advice Claudine had given me as we sat in her Beacon Street apartment those many months before. "Who can see 25 years into the future?" she had asked. "Your guess is as good as theirs. Confidence is everything." I convinced myself I was an expert, reminding myself that I had experienced more of life in developing countries than many of the men, some of them twice my age, who now sat in judgment of my work. I had lived in the Amazon and had traveled to parts of Java no one else wanted to visit. I had taken a couple of intensive courses aimed at teaching executives the finer points of econometrics, and I told myself that I was part of the new breed of statistically oriented, econometric-worshipping whiz-kids that appealed to Robert McNamara, the buttoned-down president of the World Bank, former president of Ford Motor Company, and John Kennedy's Secretary of Defense. Here was a man who had built his reputation on numbers, on probability theory, on mathematical models, and, I suspected, on the bravado of a very large ego. I tried to emulate both McNamara and my boss, Bruno. I adopted manners of speech that imitated the former, and I took to walking with the swagger of the latter, attaché case swinging at my side. Looking back, I have to wonder at my gall. In truth, my expertise was extremely limited, but what I lacked in training and knowledge, I made up for in audacity. And it worked. Eventually, the team of experts stamped my reports with their seals of approval. During the ensuing months, I attended meetings in Tehran, Caracas, Guatemala City, London, Vienna, and Washington, D.C. I met famous personalities, including the Shah of Iran, the former presidents of several countries, and Robert McNamara himself. Like prep school, it was a world of men. I was amazed at how my new title and the accounts of my recent successes before the international lending agencies affected other people's attitudes toward me. At first, all the attention went to my head. I began to think of myself as a Merlin who could wave his wand over a country, causing it suddenly to light up, industries sprouting like flowers. Then I became disillusioned. I questioned my own motives and those of all the people I worked with. It seemed that a glorified title or a PhD did little to help a person understand the plight of a leper living beside a cesspool in Jakarta, and I doubted that a knack for manipulating statistics enabled a person to see into the future. The better I came to know those who made the decisions that shaped the world, the more skeptical I became about their abilities and their goals. Looking at the faces around the meeting room tables, I found myself struggling very hard to restrain my anger. Eventually, however, this perspective also changed. I came to understand that most of these men believed they were doing the right thing. Like Charlie, they were convinced that communism and terrorism were evil forces, rather than the predictable reactions to decisions they and their predecessors had made, and that they had a duty to their country, to their offspring, and to God to convert the world to capitalism. They also clung to the principle of survival of the fittest. If they happened to enjoy the good fortune to have been born into a privileged class instead of inside a cardboard shack, then they saw it as an obligation to pass this heritage on to their progeny. I vacillated between viewing such people as an actual conspiracy and simply seeing them as a tight-knit fraternity bent on dominating the world. Nonetheless, over time I began to liken them to the plantation owners of the pre-Civil War South. They were men drawn together in a loose association by common beliefs and shared self-interest, rather than an exclusive group meeting in clandestine hideaways with focused and sinister intent. The plantation autocrats had grown up with servants and slaves, had been educated to believe that it was their right and even their duty to take care of the heathens and to convert them to the owner's religion and way of life. Even if slavery repulsed them philosophically, they could, like Thomas Jefferson, justify it as a necessity, the collapse of which would result in social and economic chaos. The leaders of the modern oligarchies, what I now thought of as the corporatocracy, seemed to fit the same mold. I also began to wonder who benefits from war and the mass production of weapons, from the damming of rivers and the destruction of indigenous environments and cultures. I began to look at who benefits when hundreds of thousands of people die from insufficient food, polluted water, or curable diseases. Slowly I came to realize that in the long run, no one benefits, but in the short term, those at the top of the pyramid, my bosses and me, appear to benefit, at least materially. This raised several other questions. Why does this situation persist? Why has it endured for so long? Does the answer lie simply in the old adage that might is right, that those with the power perpetuate the system? It seemed insufficient to say that power alone allows this situation to persist. While the proposition that might makes right explained a great deal, I felt there must be a more compelling force at work here. I recalled an economics professor from my business school days, a man from northern India, who lectured about limited resources, about man's need to grow continually, and about the principle of slave labor. According to this professor, all successful capitalist systems involve hierarchies with rigid chains of command, including a handful at the very top who control descending orders of subordinates, and a massive army of workers at the bottom who, in relative economic terms, truly can be classified as slaves. Ultimately, then, I became convinced that we encourage this system because the corporatocracy has convinced us that God has given us the right to place a few of our people at the very top of this capitalist pyramid and to export our system to the entire world. Of course, we are not the first to do this. The list of practitioners
stretches back to the ancient empires of North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, and works its way up through Persia, Greece, Rome, the Christian Crusades, and all the European empire builders of the post-Columbian era. This imperialist drive has been and continues to be the cause of most wars, pollution, starvation, species extinctions, and genocides. And it has always taken a serious toll on the conscience and well-being of the citizens of those empires, contributing to social malaise and resulting in a situation where the wealthiest cultures in human history are plagued with the highest rates of suicide, drug abuse, and violence. I thought extensively on these questions, but I avoided considering the nature of my own role in all of this. I tried to think of myself not as an EHM, but as a chief economist. It sounded so very legitimate, and if I needed any confirmation, I could look at my pay stubs. All were from Maine, a private corporation. I didn't earn a penny from the NSA or any government agency. And so I became convinced. Almost. One afternoon, Bruno called me into his office. He walked behind my chair and patted me on the shoulder.
"You've done an excellent job," he purred. "To show our appreciation, we're giving you the opportunity of a lifetime, something few men ever receive, even at twice your age."
Chapter 10. Panama's President and Hero. I landed at Panama's Tocumen International Airport late one April night in 1972, during a tropical deluge. As was common in those days, I shared a taxi with several other executives, and because I spoke Spanish, I ended up in the front seat beside the driver. I stared blankly out the taxi's windshield. Through the rain, the headlights illuminated a billboard portrait of a handsome man with a prominent brow and flashing eyes. One side of his wide-brimmed hat was hooked rakishly up. I recognized him as the hero of modern Panama, Omar Torrijos. I had prepared for this trip in my customary fashion by visiting the reference section of the Boston Public Library. I knew that one of the reasons for Torrijos's popularity among his people was that he was a firm defender of both Panama's right of self-rule and of its claims to sovereignty over the Panama Canal. He was determined that the country under his leadership would avoid the pitfalls of its ignominious history. Panama was part of Colombia when the French engineer Ferdinand de Lesseps, who directed construction of the Suez Canal, decided to build a canal through the Central American Isthmus to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Beginning in 1881, the French undertook a mammoth effort that met with one catastrophe after another. Finally, in 1889, the project ended in financial disaster, but it had inspired a dream in Theodore Roosevelt. During the first years of the 20th century, the United States demanded that Colombia sign a treaty, turning the isthmus over to a North American consortium. Colombia refused. In 1903, President Roosevelt sent in the U.S. warship Nashville. U.S. soldiers landed, seized and killed a popular local militia commander, and declared Panama an independent nation. A puppet government was installed, and the first canal treaty was signed. It established an American zone on both sides of the future waterway, legalized U.S. military intervention, and gave Washington virtual control over this newly formed independent nation. Interestingly, the treaty was signed by U.S. Secretary of State Hay and a French engineer, Philippe Bunau Varilla, who had been part of the original team. But it was not signed by a single Panamanian. In essence, Panama was forced to leave Colombia in order to serve the United States in a deal struck by an American and a Frenchman. In retrospect, a prophetic beginning. For more than half a century, Panama was ruled by an oligarchy of wealthy families with strong connections to Washington. They were right-wing dictators who took whatever measures they deemed necessary to ensure that their country promoted U.S. interests. In the manner of most of the Latin American dictators who allied themselves with Washington,
Panama's rulers interpreted U.S. interests to mean putting down any populist movement that smacked of socialism. They also supported the CIA and NSA in anti-communist activities throughout the hemisphere, and they helped big American businesses like Rockefeller's Standard Oil and United Fruit Company, which was purchased by George H.W. Bush. These governments apparently did not feel that U.S. interests were promoted by improving the lives of people who lived in dire poverty or served as virtual slaves to the big plantations and corporations. Panama's ruling families were well rewarded for their support. U.S. military forces intervened on their behalf a dozen times between the Declaration of Panamanian Independence and 1968. However, that year, while I was still a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, the course of Panamanian history suddenly changed. A coup overthrew Arnulfo Arias, the latest in the parade of dictators, and Omar Torrijos emerged as the head of state, although he had not actively participated in the coup. Torrijos was highly regarded by the Panamanian middle and lower classes. He himself had grown up in the rural city of Santiago, where his parents taught school. He had risen quickly through the ranks of the National Guard, Panama's primary military unit, and an institution that during the 1960s gained increasing support among the poor. Torrijos earned a reputation for listening to the dispossessed. He walked the streets of their shanty towns, held meetings in slums politicians didn't dare to enter, helped the unemployed find jobs, and often donated his own limited financial resources to families stricken by illness or tragedy. His love of life and his compassion for people reached even beyond Panama's borders. Torrijos was committed to turning his nation into a haven for fugitives from persecution, a place that would offer asylum to refugees from both sides of the political fence, from leftist opponents of Chile's Pinochet to right-wing anti-Castro guerrillas. Many people saw him as an agent of peace, a perception that earned him praise throughout the hemisphere. He also developed a reputation as a leader who was dedicated to resolving differences among the various factions that were tearing apart so many Latin American countries: Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Cuba, Colombia, Peru, Argentina, Chile, and Paraguay. His small nation of 2 million people served as a model of social reform and an inspiration for world leaders as diverse as the labor organizers who plotted the dismemberment of the Soviet Union and Islamic militants like Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. My first night in Panama, stopped at the traffic light, peering past the noisy windshield wipers, I was moved by this man smiling down at me from the billboard, handsome, charismatic, and courageous. I knew from my hours at the BPL that he stood behind his beliefs. For the first time in its history, Panama was not a puppet of Washington or of anyone else. Torrijos never succumbed to the temptations offered by Moscow or Beijing. He believed in social reform and in helping those born into poverty, but he did not advocate communism. Unlike Castro, Torrijos was determined to win freedom from the United States without forging alliances with the United States' enemies. I had stumbled across an article in some obscure journal in the BPL racks that praised Torrijos as a man who would alter the history of the Americas, reversing a long-term trend toward U.S. domination. The author cited, as his starting point, Manifest Destiny, the doctrine, popular with many Americans during the 1840s, that the conquest of North America was divinely ordained, that God, not men, had ordered the destruction of Indians, forests, and buffalo, the draining of swamps and the channeling of rivers, and the development of an economy that depends on the continuing exploitation of labor and natural resources. The article got me to thinking about my country's attitude toward the world. The Monroe Doctrine, originally enunciated by President James Monroe in 1823,
was used to take Manifest Destiny a step further when, in the 1850s and 1860s, it was used to assert that the United States had special rights all over the hemisphere, including the right to invade any nation in Central or South America that refused to back U.S. policies. Teddy Roosevelt invoked the Monroe Doctrine to justify U.S. intervention in the Dominican Republic, in Venezuela, and during the liberation of Panama from Colombia. A string of subsequent U.S. presidents, most notably Taft, Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt, relied on it to expand Washington's Pan-American activities through the end of World War II. Finally, during the latter half of the 20th century, the United States used the communist threat to justify expansion of this concept to countries around the globe, including Vietnam and Indonesia. Now, it seemed, one man was standing in Washington's way. I knew that he was not the first. Leaders like Castro and Allende had gone before him. But Torrijos alone was doing it outside the realm of communist ideology, and without claiming that his movement was a revolution. He was simply saying that Panama had its own rights to sovereignty over its people, its lands, and a waterway that bisected it, and that these rights were as valid and as divinely bestowed as any enjoyed by the United States. Torrijos also objected to the School of the Americas and to the U.S. Southern Command's Tropical Warfare Training Center, both located in the Canal Zone. For years, the United States Armed Forces had invited Latin American dictators and presidents to send their sons and military leaders to these facilities, the largest and best equipped outside North America. There, they learned interrogation and covert operational skills, as well as military tactics that they would use to fight communism and to protect their own assets and those of the oil companies and other private corporations. They also had opportunities to bond with the United States' top brass. These facilities were hated by Latin Americans, except for the few wealthy ones who benefited from them. They were known to provide schooling for right-wing death squads and the torturers who had turned so many nations into totalitarian regimes. Torrijos made it clear that he did not want training centers located in Panama, and that he considered the Canal Zone to be included within his borders. Seeing the handsome general on the billboard and reading the caption beneath his face, "Omar's ideal is freedom. The missile is not invented that can kill an ideal," I felt a shiver run down my spine. I had a premonition that the story of Panama in the 20th century was far from over, and that Torrijos was in for a difficult and perhaps even tragic time. The tropical storm battered against the windshield. The traffic light turned green, and the driver honked his horn at the car ahead of us. I thought about my own position. I had been sent to Panama to close the deal on what would become Maine's first truly comprehensive master development plan. This plan would create a justification for World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, and USAID investment of billions of dollars in the energy, transportation, and agricultural sectors of this tiny and very crucial country. It was, of course, a subterfuge, a means of making Panama forever indebted and thereby returning it to its puppet status. As the taxi started to move through the night, a paroxysm of guilt flashed through me, but I suppressed it. What did I care? I had taken the plunge in Java, sold my soul, and now I could create my opportunity of a lifetime. I could become rich, famous, and powerful in one blow. Chapter 11. Pirates in the Canal Zone. The next day, the Panamanian government sent a man to show me around. His name was Fidel, and I was immediately drawn to him. He was tall and slim and took an obvious pride in his country. His great-great-grandfather had fought beside Bolivar to win independence from Spain. I told him I was related to Tom Paine, and was thrilled to learn that Fidel had read Common Sense in Spanish. He spoke English, but when he discovered I was fluent in the language of his country, he was overcome with emotion. "Many of your people live here for years and never bother to learn it," he said. Fidel took me on a drive through an impressively prosperous sector of his city, which he called the New Panama. As we passed modern glass and steel skyscrapers, he explained that Panama had more international banks than any other country south of the Rio Grande. "We are often called the Switzerland of the Americas," he said. "We ask very few questions of our clients." Late in the afternoon, with the sun sliding toward the Pacific, we headed out on an avenue that followed the contours of the bay. A long line of ships was anchored there. I asked Fidel whether there was a problem with the canal. "It's always like this," he replied with a laugh. "Lines of them waiting their turn. Half the traffic is coming from or going to Japan, more even than the United States." I confessed that this was news to me. "I'm not surprised," he said. "North Americans don't know much about the rest of the world." We stopped at a beautiful park in which bougainvillea crept over ancient ruins. A sign proclaimed that this was a fort built to protect the city against marauding English pirates. A family was setting up for an evening picnic, a father, mother, son, and daughter, and an elderly man, who I assumed was the children's grandfather. I felt a sudden longing for the tranquility that seemed to embrace these five people. As we passed them, the couple smiled, waved, and greeted us in English. I asked if they were tourists, and they laughed. The man came over to us. "I'm third generation in the canal zone," he explained proudly. "My granddad came 3 years after it was created. He drove one of the mules, the tractors that hauled ships through the locks." He pointed at the elderly man, who was preoccupied helping the children set the picnic table. "My dad was an engineer, and I followed in his footsteps." The woman had returned to helping her father-in-law and children. Beyond them, the sun dipped into the blue water. It was a scene of idyllic beauty, reminiscent of a Monet painting. I asked the man if they were U.S. citizens. He looked at me incredulously. "Of course, the canal zone is U.S. territory." The boy ran up to tell his father that dinner was ready. "Will your son be the fourth generation?" The man brought his hands together in a sign of prayer and raised them toward the sky. "I pray to the good Lord every day that he may have that opportunity. Living in the zone is a wonderful life." Then he lowered his hands and stared directly at Fidel. "I just hope we can hold on to her for another 50 years. That despot Torrijos is making a lot of waves, a dangerous man." A sudden urge gripped me, and I said to him in Spanish, "Adios. I hope you and your family have a good time here and learn lots about Panama's culture." He gave me a disgusted look. "I don't speak their language," he said. Then he turned abruptly and headed toward his family and the picnic. Fidel stepped close to me, placed an arm around my shoulders, and squeezed tightly. "Thank you," he said. Back in the city, Fidel drove us through an area he described as a slum. "Not our worst," he said, "but you'll get the flavor." Wooden shacks and ditches filled with standing water lined the street. The frail homes, suggesting dilapidated boats, scuttled in a cesspool. The smell of rot and sewage filled our car, as children with distended bellies ran alongside. When we slowed, they congregated at my side, calling me uncle and begging for money. It reminded me of Jakarta. Graffiti covered many of the walls. There were a few of the usual hearts with couples' names scrawled inside, but most of the graffiti were slogans expressing hatred of the United States. "Go home, gringo. Stop shitting in our canal. Uncle Sam, slave master." And "Tell Nixon that Panama is not Vietnam." The one that chilled my heart the most, however, read, "Death for freedom is the way to Christ." Scattered among these were posters of Omar Torrijos.
Now, the other side, Fidel said. I've got official papers and you're a U.S. citizen, so we can go.
Beneath a magenta sky, he drove us into the canal zone. As prepared as I thought I was, it was not enough. I could hardly believe the opulence of the place. Huge white buildings, manicured lawns, plush homes, golf courses, stores, and theaters.
The facts, he said. Everything in here is U.S. property.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We will be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.